Soul Sister Radio.
I hear some say nothing is sweeter than love's first kiss, or getting high till you reach the sky on a cloud of bliss. But as I reflect upon my life and I reminisce, I can't dismiss that I get a thrill from love and service. That is why I'm gonna learn to love, and I'm gonna love to serve. 'Cause as I serve my brothers and sisters, I am serving the Father. Yes, I'm gonna learn.
Soul Sister Radio.
Rebecca Lawler Limited is the culmination of a lifelong dream for philanthropist and designer Rebecca Lawler. She designed her patented, unique glass heart, which is handcrafted by glass artists in Virginia. Placed in the center is a brilliant gem. The heart can be worn with the Rebecca Lawler Limited signature ribbon or an awareness ribbon of choice. To join the mission of the Hearts of Hope Foundation and add a Rebecca Lawler signature heart to your own personal style, go to RebeccaLawlerLimited.com. That's RebeccaLawlerLimited.com.
Hi, I'm Susan Shengazar. I am the advocate. Are you a healthcare professional facing burnout? Do you have a heart for the homeless? Have you ever been a victim of domestic violence or sexual abuse? You can learn from my experiences in my books, The Anointing of Mercy from the Heart of a Parish Nurse. Or I'll meet you at Winston Wall Street Journal. Journey to My Father's Palace, Destiny, Coincidence, you decide. You can find these books on Barnes & Noble, Amazon.com, or Zulon Press, or Google me.
Hello, Soul Sister listeners. If you're learning and receiving from what you're being fed here on Soul Sister Radio, return the love by becoming a monthly partner of this station via sponsorship, monetary gifts, or as a Soul Sister advertiser. Thank you for your support. Soul Sister Radio.
Welcome to Soul Sister Thursday. This is Maria DiGiovanni, and I want to welcome you to Soul Sister Radio and Suddenly Homeless with Kate Murphy. Kate, are you there with us?
I'm here, Maria.
Good. I really want you to reintroduce yourself to the audience, and I again want to thank you so much for being such a delicate piece to the puzzle that God has place before me as your calling to be a voice and a face for the homeless is definitely one that I'm called to make sure that we elevate and empower. So thank you so much for choosing to partner up with Soul Sister Radio and Soul Sister Enterprise and for being a four ambassador and soon to be a lady under the Imperial Order of St. Helens. So Kate, why don't you introduce yourself and why we are here, and we're going to start part two of four of how you got to be this title of Suddenly Homeless with Kate.
Well, it's hard to even know where to start to introduce myself. I am an advocate for the homeless. I'm a voice for those who don't have a voice. And the reason I am that is because I've experienced homelessness for myself. For the past year and a half, I've been running a resource center for the homeless and working poor and working very closely with them to help them become stable. But it's a labor of love for me because 10 years ago I lost everything, my job, my home, and all my children. And despite 25 years of business experience, making $15 an hour, not having any mental illness or addictions, it still took me over 2 years to get back on my feet. And when I came out of that in 2006, I decided that I would dedicate my career to helping to end homelessness. And I wrote the book, Suddenly Homeless, because I wanted to tell my story to see if it could help somebody else going through the same circumstance. I do speak a lot about what I went through, and people are always surprised that it would happen to me because I'm not a typical homeless person. I'm well-educated. I've had some career success, but I am a single mom. I actually have 9 children from my marriage, and I still have 3 at home, so I'm unusual in that way as well. And I wanted to share my story to both to give people an insight and maybe a little bit of mercy for the homeless rather than prejudging them, as I always did before it happened to me. And also, so if you see certain signs in your life that I saw in mine that could cause you to become homeless or put you in a compromising situation, maybe you recognize those in my life, and that would give you some insight to prevent that from happening to you.
Your testimony is so incredible, and again, I'm honored that God has placed you in my life and that you can be such a voice and an example. Because you're right, this could happen to anybody, any one of us, at any time. And again, who is to say what is promised tomorrow? Not too many things are promised for tomorrow. So again, I want you to just do a little bit of a recap of last week, just of where you grew up, okay, and let people know where you grew up. I mean, we were basically neighbors, and just recap what happened last week as we move into you growing up and getting into your young adult years.
Well, sure. I actually was born in Idaho, grew up mostly, well, when I was very young, we lived in Washington and Oregon, and then when I was 8 years old, we moved to California, and we lived in Mission Viejo, which is a very nice planned community, very nice. And I'd say we were upper middle class family. I was raised Irish Catholic. I was the fourth of six children, and it was I had a really, as far as financially speaking, I had a really good upbringing. It was a very strict Irish Catholic upbringing, but I always felt kind of a loneliness and an emptiness inside, and I could say my life was characterized by always searching for love and never quite feeling I was good enough. I have some wonderful, wonderful parents, but I asked my mom once, you know, Mom, I'll get straight A's, and you act like I did nothing because I worked so hard. And she would say, oh, but dear, if I don't continue to criticize you, you won't keep trying to get better. And I felt like I'd already done everything. So I always felt like I was trying to please people. I was trying to win people's love, to earn it in some way, and I hated conflict. So when you grow up in a family that large, conflict for me was just very, very uncomfortable. I just found out that if I kept my mouth shut and didn't complain and ignored problems, they might go away. And if they didn't go away, it was okay because I didn't want to feel the pain. So I just learned how to put up a wall and not deal with my problems. And it seemed like my opinion didn't matter. So I just learned to be quiet, stay out of trouble.
How did that work for you?
Well, not very very well. I didn't realize I was training myself to be a victim, and I just thought I was trying to stay safe. And because I wanted people's approval, if I didn't fight with them, they'd have to accept me somehow. That's what I thought. So I was always trying to, again, always trying to earn love and by staying out of trouble and not making anybody mad. And then, so all the way through high school, it looked like I was... Oh, go ahead.
My question there is, why do you think you did that?
Why did I do that? I think, well, I know I didn't feel loved and I didn't feel like I was good enough and I was trying to earn it. And I knew God was in my life, but he felt so distant. And the way I was raised in my religion, the way my family raised me was you had to count every sin and then confess it, or you weren't forgiven, you weren't accepted by God. I didn't even feel like God accepted me. I always felt like I had to earn any chance at salvation, I would just have to work and work and work. And even then, I wouldn't know if God really loved me enough for me to spend eternity in heaven, really.
Why do you think that is? Because I think you were born and raised Catholic, too. And a lot of us on the team here, on the four team and all the ambassadors, most of us are, I want to say most of us are nuns. No, most of us are Catholic that wanted to be nuns, okay?
Yes, I wanted to be a nun.
Okay, but can you share, because again, a lot of us grew up with religious backgrounds and a lot of us grew up Catholic back then. What was it like and how do you think that contributed to the choices that you ended up making?
Well, Catholicism, the way I was raised is that, like I said, you're never quite forgiven. You're always constantly having to remember the sin and confess it, or you're not forgiven. There's not any grace in that. It's always... what you do, it's always your works. And that's not really what's in the Bible. The Bible's about being saved by grace through faith. Grace is unmerited favor from God. We already have it. You can't earn it. And I kept trying to earn something that I already had. I just didn't know it. I didn't know that, you know, through Jesus Christ, I already had forgiveness. I was always trying to get re-forgiven. And you can never get there. You can never earn your way to heaven, and it's impossible. So there's this impossibly high standard that I set for myself, and my parents also set a very high standard. And yes, I wanted to be a nun, and I went on instead to have all bunches of children and get married. So it was just my desire to please God. I really wanted to please him, but I didn't know him. I didn't know he loved me. I just thought it was all about if my good deeds outweighed my bad deeds, I wouldn't go to hell. That was basically it. And that was inaccurate, but that's all I knew. I had an uncle, my only uncle on my dad's side was a priest, and he was raised from birth to be a priest. That's just the kind of family I came from, where religion was very important. Appearances were very, very important. So.
Okay, let me stop you there. Appearances. Now,
yeah.
How much of what you were actually living was reality, and how much was it just an appearance?
Oh, my goodness. 99% appearances, because that was the biggest thing. You keep up those appearances. 1% probably reality. I was so miserable inside that I used, by the time I was in high school, even though I looked like the perfect child, straight A's, I was a homecoming princess, an exchange student, a varsity cheerleader, doesn't matter. I used to think of ways I could kill myself and that there were no chance I would survive, because I knew if I survived, my mother would, you know, she'd never let me get over it. She'd never forgive me for it. So I never did come up with a foolproof way, fortunately. But that's how it was. If you looked good, that was okay, but I wasn't living who I really was, and I didn't feel like I had permission. I always had to appear to be perfect, regardless of the reality. So, of course, you can't tell anybody about your struggles or your problems or that you feel like killing yourself. That is just not acceptable. It was always, and my mom was always like, well, you know, you just have to, you offer those things up to God. It helps you get into heaven. You suffer now, better chance to get into heaven. So I suffered silently, mostly, but I didn't deal with anything.
And most of us didn't, which brings us to, you know, you now recognize, after being out of all of this for some time now, that you kind of re-victimized yourself over and over and over. At what age do you think that you can really put your finger on that you became a victim, number one? And then at what age did you continue being the one who was abusing yourself?
I trace being a victim all the way back to when I was very young, probably as soon as I was able to communicate with other people. I found out that I wasn't allowed to communicate what I was really thinking, because it would just bring punishment. Punishment was a big deal in my family. I had a sister who was 13 months older than me who absolutely hated me, and we were forced to share everything. It just seemed like she hated me, and anything she could do to hurt me, she would do it. And it could have just been, I was hypersensitive and she was very, the opposite. We're opposite personalities. But from very young, I was always trying to please this sister who I felt like hated me. So she would use me as her personal slave. She'd be, you know, in the bathroom and forget a towel and say, Kathy, go get me a towel, you know, it'd be my job to run off and get it. And God forbid I should ever try to argue with her, because I'd pay for it later. You know, and that got into later on. Oh, go ahead.
Was this an Irish thing?
I thought
it was an Italian thing.
Oh my gosh! No, I was a slave to my sister, because it was self-preservation, and
yeah, how
I just couldn't.
How older was she?
Only 13 months older. We were very close. We shared everything down to our underwear, and she always got first pick of. My mom would buy us the same clothes in different colors. My sister always got first pick. She was always put ahead of me. You know, she was, because she was older. She automatically got more privileges just because. So
okay.
I learned if I complained about how she treated me, my mother would side with her. So it was, I couldn't win.
Okay. How do you think that contributed to where you ended up being a mother of nine and homeless?
Well, I was used
to
being told what to do.
Okay.
I was used to being controlled, and eventually when I met my husband, what I realized years later, my mother's extremely controlling and perfectionistic, and one of her primary motivations is that if her children make a mistake, it reflects poorly on her. So if I ever messed up, I would really get in big trouble because she felt it made her look bad. Well, I didn't realize that when I met my husband, he treated me in many ways like my mother did. He was very controlling, and he basically told me what to do and how I should think and how I should dress and who my friends should be, which ended up being nobody. So I basically married my mother, because I was at some level I was comfortable with being treated that way, with having somebody else think for me and make all my decisions. Somewhere I made a decision that I wanted to be in that kind of relationship. Somehow that was comfortable for me. So I made myself a victim. Now, the nine children, actually, that was my desire. Because when I was really young, I read the original Cheaper by the Dozen book where they had 12 children. And I, for some reason, I really wanted 12 children. And I kept having children even though my marriage was very bad from the day we got married. It was bad. But I didn't believe in divorce, so that wasn't an option. So I just focused on how can I bring the best out of this. And those children met a need that my husband couldn't meet. He couldn't love me. But my children loved me, and they needed me. So somehow that compensated in some way for having a very bad marriage.
Right. Well, they took up all your time and you didn't have the opportunity to pay attention to what was going on in your own personal life. That's
yep.
common. Nine children. God bless you. I think myself, oh dear Lord, but look at all the blessings that you have now with all of these kids and your grandkids when it was the worst time, I can only imagine, and this is what we're going to go into next week, because we're down to 8 minutes left. 9 minutes left before we're done with this show. And but next week I want you to talk about what it's like to really, first you get to that place where you know that you're going to be losing your job, or you lost your job and you know that you don't have enough to pay rent and all that. I want you to talk about what it was feeling like, especially with 9 children and being responsible for all of these children next week. So
okay.
I want you to kind of give us a little snippet of what that's going to be like and how it was like for your children.
Okay. I will do that. Can we talk about that now or next week?
Well, I want you to just share a little bit about what we're going to be talking about.
Well, I wrote the book about my story, Suddenly Homeless, and in a way, it was sudden, but it was built. I didn't realize I'd been kind of preparing for it all my life, just expecting the worst to happen to me was kind of the mode that I was in, which also is, you know, that's my victim mode. And I was a strong Christian. I loved God, and I was doing everything I could to obey Him, and it took a very long time for God to convince me that the only way to protect my children was to get a divorce. I was totally opposed to divorce for so many years, which is why I stayed married for 17 years until it became clear to me that my children were in a lot of danger. So,
let me ask you about that real quick, okay? Because that kind of is important. Because you had to make that choice to get a divorce before you became homeless, correct?
I did. It was 2 years before I became homeless.
Okay, so here it is. You have 9 children, and you're in a marriage that you're not so happy with for whatever reason. We have listeners out there that are walking similar paths. Can you share a little bit about what that was like? And like you said, you lasted 17 years because divorce wasn't an option. So can you share a little bit? We do have time, 7 minutes. So share what that was like.
Well, I had built up a certain numbness over the years because I knew I was in a bad situation. I knew my kids were in a bad situation. And you just become numb. And I knew it wasn't right. I knew it wasn't fair to my kids because I pretty much had to ignore the pain they were going through. I was out working full-time, supporting the family. My husband was at home with the kids. And they were suffering, and I just couldn't deal with it. So I convinced myself it was okay, that they were going to be all right, that God was going to fix my husband. And really, I didn't realize that was my choice. It wasn't God's will in any way, shape, or form. I don't believe it's ever God's will to stay in an abusive situation, ever. And not only was I being abused, my kids were being abused, and that's just wrong. There's no good thing about that. But it was easier for years for me to just stay numb. Really to stay numb. And that's all I can describe it as. I was just emotionally numb. I couldn't feel what my kids were feeling, and I didn't always, I think I loved my kids, but because I wouldn't allow myself to feel their pain, I couldn't have really been loving them because I had to shut off my emotions just so I could keep going day to day. And what I really should have...
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I'm just saying what I really should have done is just said, what's more important here? I used to think that it was wrong to get divorced partly because I didn't feel like there was a scripture that said it was okay to divorce in the case of abuse, but I felt like I would be making my children basically fatherless. And then it was, and when you look at it, when I look at it now, that's ridiculous because he wasn't any kind of a father whatsoever. He didn't provide. He wasn't giving his kids good guidance. He wasn't loving them. He was hurting them. But somehow in my mind, I thought their father must be in the picture. That's the only good picture I had in my head of a Christian marriage. So I just thought God had put up with it no matter what. And that again, that was just not God's will. It was what I thought was right. It was the whole thing about appearances. What a stigma it is to be a divorced Christian woman and have all these kids. And people would just look at me and say, well, why couldn't you work that out? That's how I thought. But it was beyond fixing. You can't fix another person, and I never should have. Well, I used to put that on God. I used to say, you know, you can fix him, Lord. You can fix him. And after years when he didn't get fixed, I would say, okay, Lord, you need to kill him or kill me. Because, again, divorce was not an option. So one of us has got to go. And that's really, when you think about it, it's insane. But
oh, no,
that's
I
where
understand.
I was at.
I understand it. Now, I wanted to ask you real quick. There's different ways. How do you think you got to a point where you numbed yourself out? What types of ways would you numb yourself out?
Well, with me, because I was away from the house so much, that was part of it. I wasn't using any kind of drugs or anything, although there were times I'm glad I didn't, but I suppose I could have slipped into that. But I would come home from work, and I'd have all these kids running to me and saying, Mom, you're not going to believe what Dad did to us today. And first I would feel this huge wave of guilt, and then I would just turn it off. And I'd say, okay, Lord, this is your fault, not mine. You're going to have to fix this, man. You brought us together. You need to fix it. So it was just, I just would put up, day after day, I'd put up that emotional wall and say, I'm not going to feel anything. Because I could just see my life was a house of cards. And if it fell over, I felt like I wouldn't have anything left. If my marriage really fell apart, I couldn't even conceive of being strong enough to support those kids or to make it. And of course, my husband would tell me that all the time. You can't make it out without me. You need me. Without me, you're useless. And I believed that, and I just couldn't get to the point where I felt strong enough to survive that. So I just wouldn't allow myself to even consider it. I wouldn't consider divorce, and that meant I wasn't able to feel my kids' feelings. It was just a daily thing. And I would go home from work, immediately I'd get a stomach ache, and I'd have chest pains almost every day, panic attacks. But you know, that's because I was just ignoring the reality that I was in.
You know, we're going to talk more and more about what you just said, because I truly, truly believe that a lot of the sicknesses that women do have, and I don't mean to disrespect anyone, but most of them start in our head, meaning they are a physical manifestation of what is emotionally going on inside. And I truly believe that a lot of us are sick because our body is telling us something emotionally is going on. And I truly believe that's what was happening to you. You weren't opening your mouth and talking and sharing, so your body was going to just shut down. So something would be complaining, because everything was perfect, right? Everything was wonderful. Especially when you go to church, in the Catholic Church, and everything's perfect.
Right.
And so next week I'm excited, because we're going to move into a little bit more of again, having 9 children and having to make some incredible choices in this homelessness journey. So can you go ahead and share with your audience where they can get a hold of you on Facebook and your website?
Yes, I'm at www.facebook.com/suddenlyhomelesswithkate, C-A-T-E. I spell my name with a C. And I'm sorry, what was the other thing?
And your website that's going to be going up soon, very, very soon, is?
Also, suddenlyhomelesswithkate.com.
Amen. Hallelujah. Again, thank you so much, Kate, for having your show here on Soul Sister Radio. And I just want to thank you again. Would you like to close out your show? And we will see everybody next week.
Yes, thank you everyone for listening, and I hope it's been a blessing. And please visit the website, and if you like, you can message me on Facebook and give me your thoughts, and maybe if there's something that you'd like to share with me, I'd be more than happy to see it. You can also get my book right now on createspace.com. It is available, Suddenly Homeless with Kate, on createspace.com.
Perfect. We will see you next week with Suddenly Homeless with Kate on Soul Sister Thursday.
Soul Sister Radio.
Rebecca Lawler Limited is the culmination of a lifelong dream for philanthropist and designer Rebecca Lawler. She designed her patented, unique glass heart, which is handcrafted by glass artists in Virginia. Placed in the center is a brilliant gem. The heart can be worn with the Rebecca Lawler Limited signature ribbon or an awareness ribbon of choice. To join the mission of the Hearts of Hope Foundation and add a Rebecca Lawler signature heart to your own personal style, go to RebeccaLawlerLimited.com. That's RebeccaLawlerLimited.com.
Hi, I'm Susan Shengazar. I am the advocate. Are you a healthcare professional facing burnout? Do you have a heart for the homeless? Have you ever been a victim of domestic violence or sexual abuse? You can learn from my experiences in my books, The Anointing of Mercy from the Heart of a Parish Nurse. Or I'll meet you at Winston Wall Street Journal's Journey to My Father's Palace, Destiny, Coincidence, You Decide. You can find these books on Barnes & Noble, Amazon.com, or Zulon Press, or Google me.
Hello, Soul Sister listeners. If you're learning and receiving from what you're being fed here on Soul Sister Radio, return the love by becoming a monthly partner of this station via sponsorship, monetary gifts, or as a Soul Sister advertiser. Thank you for your support.
I was a dead man, out in the cold. Life was a pit and I was deep in a hole, just about to give up. Then lo and behold, a voice from within said, save your soul. Yo, brothers and sisters all around the globe, I got a story, word. Gotta be told to my family, friends, fans, even my foes. It's like this, y'all, this is how it goes. I was out in the world without a name or a goal, huh? Out of school and out of control. Set in my ways, yeah, stuck in the mold. And going the wrong way down a one-way road. Young and bold, I didn't wanna be told. I used to steal and brag about the stuff I stole. Then one bright day, my mind got blown when a voice from within said, save your soul. No, I didn't want to be told. Things were looking up and I was on a roll. I was a rude boy and a Romeo. And anywhere I went, I started the show. I had money, woman, plenty of gold, and an overinflated EGO. I was a dead man, but I didn't know until a voice from within said, save your soul. A movie, and I was playing the role of a black youth living in the ghetto. Where the action was, that's where I'd go. Right or wrong, I'll be going with the flow. But what you reap is what you sow. It's like karma, the bad you do will follow. You were round, and I was going down, right down, with my face in the ground. Two hands bound to a siren sound. None of my so-called friends anywhere to be found. As I thought to myself, in life you're alone. A voice from within said, anyone home? Yes, Lord, well here I be. If I ain't ready yet, I will never be. I'm sorry for the things that I did before. Believe me, Lord, I won't do them no more. I'll be an arrow if you will be my bow. And anywhere I'm sent, I'll gladly go. I'll be a witness all around the world to every man, every woman, every boy and girl. Cause I was born in the ghetto with a strong survive and with a will to strive. I began to rise from 79, or was it 75? When reggae music began to open my eyes about the truth, the right, Jah the Most High, and how to achieve
achieve that little pie in the sky. Inspirated, yeah, I was totally motivated to the point where I decided to chop the mic. But my direction was not to only those of my complexion, but the brown, yellow, red, and the white man. Critics criticize, cynics cynicize, any entertainer with a message they victimize. But in this world of sin, it's no surprise. So with the media, I sympathize. I hear the rich man's laughter, hear the poor man's cries. Hypocrites advertise their lies through their eyes. Everyone's born, most of us die, but only God's children get the prize. Don't be a fool, be cool, come on and get wise. Yeah, wise up, no compromise. And listen to the voice that resides within your mind, cause God has sent a guide to all mankind. Choice is yours, life above or death below. It's up to you to save your soul.
Soul Sister Radio.
Welcome to Soul Sister Thursday. This is Maria DiGiovanni, and I want to welcome you to Soul Sister Radio and The Advocate with Susan Shengazar. Susan, take it away.
Thank you, Maria. And welcome all of you to Soul Sister Radio. Today is the 27th day of June. What a beautiful day. And what a beautiful world we have to stand in. And I just want you to know that God is still alive. And those of you who are listening who are suffering and struggling with things in your life, I want you to hang on and I want you to listen to what I'm about to read to you. This is a little story that comes in a little booklet called Our Daily Bread, and it's entitled No Batteries. It says, my two-year-old grandson was fascinated by the bubbling, muddy pool, the result of a geothermal activity in Rotorua, New Zealand. On moving to another spot and seeing no bubbles there, he remarked, no batteries. He was so accustomed to his electronic toys that he attributed every natural phenomena to battery power. Christians make a similar mistake. They look to their own honey power to live righteous lives, but the high moral and ethical standards of a holy God prove impossible to live up to. The result is joyless Christians, hopelessly burdened and defeated. Paul's prayer for the believers in Ephesus was that your eyes, your understanding be enlightened, that you may know what is the hope of his calling and what is the exceeding greatness of his power towards us to believe. Ephesians 1:18 and 19. He wanted them to see that the power available to help them live God-honoring lives is the same power that raised Christ from the dead and seated him at his right hand in heavenly places. The power to live according to God's standards comes only when we plug into his inexhaustible power. How do you do that? By daily seeking his face and asking him to fill us with his Holy Spirit. Fill each heart and reign alone, break the idols we have known. Lead us to confession true, give us strength, thy will to do. Peterson, author unknown. And the same power that I'm speaking of is the same power that every miracle that was recorded in God's Word, the Holy Bible, and what is recorded on the lips and minds and hearts of believers that we share, and some know it most, called a testimony. And I am a nurse by trade, an emergency room nurse. I'm an ordained minister, author of 3 books, but more than that, I'm human. And I've seen our bodies fail. I've seen people cry out in agony and pain and suffering. The other day in the hospital, I had the pleasure of taking care of a man who was suffering. And as I gave him medications for what he was there for, ailing him, another thing was ailing him more than that. And it was his heart crying out for God. But God used me, a simple woman who asks for an assignment every day from God. And I looked at him, his hand withered on his left side of his body. He could only move his left thumb. And this was not what he was there for. He tells me of his pain and suffering, how he doesn't have use of his left hand anymore, and how that was stopping him. It was his main focus, even though he was there for something else. I asked him if he believed that Jesus could heal his hand, like the man in the Bible when Jesus said, "Stretch out your hand and be made whole." He said yes, and I asked if I could pray for him. I went to take his hand, and he said, "Don't straighten my fingers because you'll break them." So I laid his hand inside mine. His hand was skinny and withered. His thumb only moved. He closed his eyes, and as I prayed, I felt his hand open up within mine. The more I prayed, the more he sobbed and cried. And then his hand opened. I put my other hand on top of it, and I said, "Paul, look at your hand." His hand was completely made whole. He started to sob uncontrollably, and I said, "Thank Jesus. I didn't do this. Jesus did." And at the same time, the doctor who came to admit him to the hospital for what he was there for came in the room and said, "Why are you crying?" And he said to her, "She just prayed for me, and my hand is healed." Three other nurses who saw him before came in and witnessed the event. This is not man, this is God, because I can do nothing without my Heavenly Father. But I thank God that I was the instrument to help this man, because he checked out against medical advice, which I did not advise. It was his choice. His mother, who was there to pick him up on dialysis, asked if she could be made whole also. So for Paul, this was a miracle. Today on our show, I bring to you a woman whose life also is a miracle. A testimony that for 25 years, her story has helped other men, women, and children standing today. She's instrumental in so many things. Her name is Julie Owens, and she's a survivor, a pastor's daughter, who has worked to end domestic violence for 25 years. Her story is featured in the documentary Broken Vows, Religious Perspectives on Domestic Violence, and the TV documentary When Love Hurts, as well as several books, including Domestic Violence, What Every Pastor Needs to Know. Julie has developed a hospital domestic violence crisis team, domestic violence counselor certification programs and trauma research projects, has managed faith-based victim shelters. She's an expert consultant for the Department of Justice for Victims of Crimes Training and Technical Assistance Center, and has written chapters in three books published about domestic violence in the church. Julie is a region director for North Carolina Council for Women, where she oversees victim service programs in 20 counties. She trains and consults nationally and internationally. This is not all that Julie Owens does and will do for our world. A welcome to the show, Julie Owens. Hello, Julie.
Thank you, Susan. What a nice introduction. It's really a blessing to be here.
Oh, I'm so thrilled that we have the opportunity to have the world learn more about women like you.
Well, there are lots of us out there.
Yes, there are.
Way too many,
actually. If the devil knew what he did to you would cause a testimony, he would not have touched you.
I believe you're right about that.
I know I am.
Same for you and for lots of others who are out there really standing in the light and teaching and you know, showing the truth and bringing the darkness to the light.
I really believe, Julie, that God's way of vengeance is mine. This is part of that.
It's sweet vengeance.
It sure is, because when you're going through it and you think, "God, where are you? Why is this happening?" and you feel so alone in that time.
Right.
But he watched you go through that, you and your father, and he watched how you forgave each person who came against you, And that's what allowed you to walk in the destiny you're in today.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I don't know how people do it when they don't have God. I know people who have survived, who've been through terrible things, but who don't have faith. And their experience, they are walking and talking, but their experience is totally different. The transformation that can happen when you're changed physically, emotionally, psychologically, and spiritually, without God, I don't know how you can become whole. And we were blessed that we were already Christians. And, of course, Dad was a pastor. And, you know, we were strong in our faith. And I think that had a lot to do with how quickly we healed on every level. Because, you know, by all rights, we should still be the walking wounded and, you know, afraid and hiding. But, you know, we're not. So there are some things you just can't explain. And that peace that passes understanding is a real deal.
Julie, do you feel like since 1988 when this happened, and I was reading your bio, and were you going through a divorce at that time? You filed divorce, or?
Yes. We had only been married for 2 years. When I married David, it was my first marriage. I was 32 years old. He was wonderful to me in the courtship. Just couldn't have been more loving and wonderful. All my friends loved him. But as soon as we got married, literally the week we got married, he started with the emotional and verbal abuse and psychological abuse and the jealousy and it just escalated so quickly that I couldn't believe it. But I ended up leaving him 3 months after we married, but I was already pregnant by then. And so we were separated for 3 months and then reconciled. And so altogether it was less than 2 years. But in all that time, he didn't physically abuse me, and I think that's really important for people to know that you don't have to be getting hit to be getting battered. And he was really torturing me psychologically. And so the physical abuse did not start until after I filed for divorce.
Wow.
Go
ahead.
Now, I was just going to say, the reason I think that's terribly important is, he had grabbed me, you know, to restrain me, to keep me from going out the door, and on one of those occasions, he shoved me backwards onto the bed. But he had not laid a hand on me in terms of a slap or a punch or anything like that. He had done other things. He had done practically everything. Anyone who's familiar with the power and control wheel, the graphic, you know, thrown things, broken things, pulled the phones out of the wall, you know, all kinds of things. But he hadn't hit me. And I think a lot of times we don't take it seriously until somebody's been physically injured. But we can't do that because sometimes it goes from 0 to 100 very quickly. And that's why one of the things I do in training is teach how to assess dangerousness and how to safety plan, because safety is the most important thing. When we're just saying to someone, get out, get out, get out, is not good enough, because when you get out is when it's the most dangerous.
Oh, yes. I was on the receiving end with my last marriage, because it was more emotional and monetarily abuse, mm-hmm. and I knew for a while that I was getting out, and he knew too. He suspected, and his plan of attack on me was so lethal that it took everything in my being to be strong and endure it. It was almost, it would have been easier to be punched physically in the face than go through what he put me through.
Yeah, I completely understand that, and I believe you. And I've heard that said many, many times. And I'll say it myself, you know, there were things he did to me that were worse than what he ultimately did, which is pretty darn bad, as you know. Yeah. The psychological abuse is torture. It's torture.
I'm really glad you bring that up, because a lot of times people say, well, did he hit you? And that, they don't get it. They don't get when you're saying, you don't see what he's doing. I mean, taking your food out of the refrigerator, shutting off the hot water, turning the electricity off when you have to be at work, you know, all the
pulling the spark plugs out of the car so you can't go anywhere, pulling the phones out of the wall. This is before cell phones. I mean, there's so many different ways. Sleep deprivation was one of the worst. He would keep me up all night, harassing me and yelling at me and screaming at me and questioning me and interrogating me and calling me names until I would be sobbing and crying and begging him, please let me sleep, because I had to go to work the next day. I worked in a junior high school with hearing impaired kids, and I couldn't function because I was so tired. And so really, anybody who thinks the physical abuse is the worst hasn't been there, because I've met so many domestic violence survivors and victims over the years, and I have yet to hear one say the physical abuse was the worst. I'm sure there's some who do, of course, when it's so, you know, egregious, but in most cases, no. It's the constant harassment and the atmosphere of terror. It's living under siege.
I used to think, this is Maria, I used to say when I was teaching, and I used to think and preach, that the physical abuse was the sanity of it all. At least with a broken jaw or a broken arm or a broken rib or some bruise or a black eye, there was proof. At least I had proof. Okay,
so. And it's against the law, you know, and, you know, theoretically someone could do something about it, right?
It was the sanity. It was where the emotional and the mental and the verbal, especially being married to a law enforcement officer, that is where you really become insane. And so,
because who you're going to call?
Exactly. Well, again, at least with the physical abuse, I had proof. But with all the other stuff, it just is crazy making.
It is crazy making, and it's, you all have probably heard the term gaslighting. It's often called gaslighting because of the old black and white movie Gaslight, where the man drove his wife crazy, literally purposely, because it's not done randomly. It is very, very, abusers know what they're doing. They know how to make someone, you know, push someone to the edge. And that's why so many domestic violence victims end up in psychiatric hospitals, or they end up saying to people like me, well, I'm crazy. He says I'm crazy, and I am. And the thing is, you know, you're not crazy. She's not crazy. But what's happening is your mind has been manipulated to such a degree that he's trying to get you off balance so that you will look that way and people will believe him when he says, well, what she's saying isn't true. You know, I didn't do anything to her. She's, you know how she is. And so, you know, we're in this catch-22, because if we then go to a counselor and we get antidepressants or anti-anxiety meds or something, then he could go, look, she's on psychiatric medications. I told you she was crazy, you know. And there was a woman near here just recently who was in the same situation and married to someone who whose best friend was in a very high-profile law enforcement position, and this was just probably 2 months ago here. And she ended up killing herself, and it just broke my heart, because she didn't think that she was going to be able to, nobody was going to believe her. He had everybody convinced that she really was, you know, nuts. And I see why that happens. So one out of four women who's being abused does attempt suicide.
And I really think that's why we're talking about this. You know, Julie, it was a year ago, almost to the month, that I was up all night being tormented with my husband in my room, trying to have sex with me. Well, he was supposed to be living in the other room, tormenting me, just, and there was a roommate in the house who did nothing to help me, and I didn't get any sleep. And I'm a highly decorated emergency nurse, and I come to work the next day, and I literally ended up saying to one of the doctors, I just said, I'm done. And he looked at me and said, what do you mean? And I said, I'm done. I'm going to walk out of here in about 5 minutes. And he looked at me, and he saw that my eyes were about ready to cry. And he said, are you okay? And I said, no, I'm not. Because I had been holding it inside,
right.
And it just couldn't take it anymore.
No.
And I said, God, I'm done. Right. And I was to the point where I was going to walk out of my career and everything because I was exploding inside with nowhere to hide. My lawyer was even abusing me. And so, you know, because he didn't think what was going on in the house was abuse. Yet, you know, I'm paying him to help me. And so you feel trapped. And so for that
it
woman,
is a trap. It is
suicide.
It is a hostage situation. And that is what when I do training, whether it's for a government or for a church or a nonprofit or law enforcement, I train that, you know, betterers take hostages. It's a hostage situation. And all of the criteria that prisoners of war live with in a true hostage situation is the same thing that battered women live with. In fact, most genuine hostage situations in the United States are domestic violence hostage situations. So sometimes it reaches the level, and I was there, and you may have been too, when I was a literal hostage. But being a psychological hostage is equally devastating, and perhaps more so, because there's a door there. We're looking at the door, but we can't walk out of it because it's too dangerous. And other people can't see that. All they can see is the door. But we have to trade our escape skills for coping skills in order to stay alive. And when we do that, other people make judgments about us and misunderstand why we're doing what we're doing and going, well, you know, she must like it or she would leave or she must be stupid or, you know, what's wrong with her? And what they don't get is that the most dangerous thing a battered woman can do is leave. 75% of the time when a woman is killed by her partners after she's left, the rest are planning to leave. And so until pastors and churches and psychologists and basically all of society really understands domestic violence for what it is, and we help people leave safely, we're going to keep pushing women into situations that put them in actually more danger.
I see that very clearly. A lot of people, you know, come to us, and, of course, I'm on the board with Safe Passage, and we help women when they're out of the abuse situation. Hmm. And fortunately, I had them, you know, praying for me and talking with me, and being a minister, it was so much worse because people were looking at me like, you're a minister, why is this happening to you?
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't matter who you are, whether
no.
you're the president of the United States,
right.
People can be abusive. And abuse is not always on the front lines where people can see it. It happens behind closed doors. But it was so hard for people to go, well, I thought you guys were doing ministry. And I kept his secrets from everyone because I am a Christian, and I wanted not everyone to know what was going on because I had believed that it would change. So listening and watching other people come to me and say, should I get out and stuff, it's a careful avenue that you walk people through because like we have a woman who teaches about document the abuse because...
Yes, doing an affidavit, yes.
Yes, because of this very reason. That
right.
Someday, during your plan, you will get out.
Yeah, and you'll need that. And there are a lot of great tools now that weren't available back in 1988, and you talk about your attorney even being abusive. Well, mine wasn't abusive, but when I went to him... the day my husband held me at knife point all night long and was threatening to, we were living with my parents because I had left him, and then we reconciled in my parents' home, and so he woke me up in the middle of the night, and he had a carpet knife, and he was threatening to cut me with it if I yelled, and he kept me all night long at knife point, and this was before I had been hit or anything. This was the first physical violence, really, but it's because he knew I was getting ready to leave, and he said, you know, if you scream and wake up your father, I'm going to cut his eyes out and drip every drop of blood from his body. My dad's this beautiful man of God, this amazing, amazing pastor and biblical scholar. I mean, he's just got this amazing soul. Anyway, you know, so here I was in this situation, and so I didn't know what to do, and I went and talked to an attorney in our church. The next day was Sunday. I got up. I went, and I was up all night, of course, terrified. He finally fell asleep, and I took the knife away, and I hid it. And the next morning, I'm just sort of in shock, literally, I think, and I'm standing, staring in the bathroom mirror, just staring, trying to figure out, what am I going to do? How am I going to get out of this marriage? How am I going to get away from him without my parents getting hurt and me and the baby? And, you know, how am I going to do this? I can't go to a shelter because then my parents will still be here. And he shows up over my shoulder looking in the mirror, looking in my eyes in the mirror, and says, Julie, where's the knife? And I said, I don't have it. He kept wanting to know where the knife was, and I figured out later it was because his fingerprints were on it. But he said, I should have killed you last night when I had the chance. And that's when I knew, oh, my God, you know, no matter what, I have to get out. So I went to see a lawyer in our church the next morning, and he said to me, I said, should I get a restraining order? I mean, I didn't really get it that it was domestic violence, but I got it that he was dangerous. And he said, no, don't worry, we'll do that in the divorce proceedings. There's laws against assault. Well, that's true, and I don't think, you know, I don't think a restraining order would have helped in my case, and I think a lot of times it doesn't. But the worst thing he said was, after all was said and done, and I had already been, you know, horribly injured, and so had my dad, just, you know, less than 2 weeks later, I went back to the same lawyer and I said, well, he did it. What should I do? And he said, you need to take the baby to the prison because bad fathers are better than no father at all. You know, and I was really struggling.
Lord.
So, I mean, I got lots of bad advice and a lot of advice from Christians who meant well, but they didn't have any idea about the safety concerns or what was really in my best interest physically or psychologically or in any other way. So, but, you know, when you talked about being a decorated nurse, that really struck a chord with me because I helped develop some trauma therapy for formerly battered women that works on their guilt, you know, the coulda, shoulda, woulda stuff that keeps people stuck and keeps post-traumatic stress disorder really hanging in there with survivors of trauma. And one of my therapy patients was the head of a large emergency room, brilliant woman. And despite how smart she was married to a police officer, and every night she and her children, all three or four, had to sleep in the hallway of their home. And she'd get up and she would go and run that emergency room the next day. So I know exactly, it doesn't matter how smart you are, it doesn't matter how talented or educated or anything, when you have somebody who has your life in the balance, you're going to do what they say, and it is a hostage situation.
Julie, with that, we're going to come right back with a station break and finish your story. This is Susan Shengazar. You're listening to The Advocate, and we'll be right back with Julie Owens.
Soul Sister Radio.
Rebecca Lawler Limited is the culmination of a lifelong dream for philanthropist and designer Rebecca Lawler. She designed her patented, unique glass heart, which is handcrafted by glass artists in Virginia. Placed in the center is a brilliant gem. The heart can be worn with the Rebecca Lawler Limited signature ribbon or an awareness ribbon of choice. To join the mission of the Hearts of Hope Foundation and add a Rebecca Lawler signature heart to your own personal style, go to RebeccaLawlerLimited.com. That's RebeccaLawlerLimited.com.
Hi, I'm Susan Shengazar. I am The Advocate. Are you a healthcare professional facing burnout? Do you have a heart for the homeless? Have you ever been a victim of domestic violence or sexual abuse? you can learn from my experiences in my books, The Anointing of Mercy from the Heart of a Parish Nurse. Or I'll meet you at Winston and Wall Street Journal. Journey to My Father's Palace, Destiny, Coincidence, you decide. You can find these books on Barnes & Noble, Amazon.com, or Zulon Press, or Google me.
Hello, Soul Sister listeners. If you're learning and receiving from what you're being fed here on Soul Sister Radio, return the love by becoming a monthly partner of this station via sponsorship, monetary gifts, or as a Soul Sister advertiser. Thank you for your support. Soul Sister Radio.
Welcome back to Soul Sister Radio, and we have with us today Julie Owens. And Julie, I would like you to come back with us and take us to the place where you are now on the place in your life where you and your father get attacked 2 weeks after this lawyer denies you a restraining order. What happened?
Well, my family supported me 100%. They were heartbroken that the marriage wasn't going to survive, but they knew that I had done everything. We had seen pastors. He had gone into drug and alcohol treatment for the 3 months that we were separated, because that was a problem he had too. We had gone to marriage counseling every week, once or twice. And, you know, I had made an agreement. He had made an agreement that he would do certain things, and he broke his agreement, and things just continued. And so my family stood behind me, and my dad said, you know, David, we love you. You'll always be the baby's father, but Julie can't live like this. And, you know, you need to move out. She is going to get a divorce, and we are supporting her. Well, I think that's why he was so enraged with my father, even though he really adored him and he saw him as a father figure, because his father had been not the nicest man. And at any rate, to make a long story short, we several weeks after this, maybe not, I don't think it was even 2 weeks, but my mother had to go out of town. My dad and I were out one evening with church friends, and we arrived back. We were in separate cars. I arrived with my baby, and Dad had stopped at a store. I walked into an ambush. My ex-husband had broken into the house, was waiting for me. He had cut the phone lines. He was waiting with a knife in the dark, and he attacked me and ambushed me and started just savagely beating me. And he said, where's your father? Where's your father? I'm going to kill your father. And he forced me into another room. He had a knife. He stuck it in my throat, and he held me at knife point while he was telling me what he was going to do to my father. And my father got home later. I lied. I tried to get him to go away, of course, and to no avail. He knew what he was planning. And when my dad got home, he let go of me and ran towards him with the knife over his head, screaming and shouting. And I tried to grab him to hold him back, and he stabbed me in the stomach. And he did attack my father and tried to cut his eyes out, which is what he told me he would do. He cut him through his eyebrows. My dad later had 40-some-odd stitches. But I thought my father's eyes were gone. We were in the dark. We were fighting for our lives, and it was just, you know, like something out of a horror film. Something told me, and I know it was the Holy Spirit, turn the lights on, because nothing was stopping him. He was unstoppable, you know. And I ran, and I turned on the lights, and he saw the blood everywhere on us, and he ran. And
wow,
of course, there's
Julie,
a lot more to the story.
Me when you said turn the light on.
Yeah,
because
I know
it.
So the light is
darkness.
Very meaningful in so many ways. I've got so many stories about the light and why, you know, we stand in the light, because we have to bring light into the darkness. And in that case, it was literal. It stopped the evil in its tracks. But, and so, you know, the analogies are everywhere. But the neighbors had been calling the police all this time. They heard me screaming. Even before he attacked me, they had heard somebody break in the house, and the police never came. They didn't come until it was over. And we thought my father's eyes were gone because his forehead was laid down over his eyes. And we got in the ambulance and realized that his eyes weren't gone. And, of course, to me, I mean, I was already, you know, I was living the rest of my life in my head with my father blinded because of the choice I had made to marry this man. And so I, you know, when we got, I got in the, when we were, they put us in the ambulance, I didn't even know I was stabbed. The police officer said, "What happened to your stomach?" I said, "I don't know. What do you mean?" And she said, "Well, you know, there was a hole in my shirt and blood." And she lifted it up. She says, "It looks like you got stabbed." And I said, "Yeah, I guess so." You know, real nonchalant, because you know how you are in the in a traumatic event. You know, you're the adrenaline's running, and you know, you're fortunately you're numbed out by all the lovely hormones or you know stress hormones running through your body. Those are the things that causes trouble later on if they don't, if the tap doesn't turn off and PTSD develops, which I ended up later studying as a result. I did develop post-traumatic stress disorder. But after this happened, they did pick him up that night. He awaited trial for 2 years. Eventually he pled to a lesser charge. Instead of attempted murders, it was attempted manslaughter. He was convicted of that and kidnapping me and some other things, and he got a 20-year sentence with a 10-year minimum. Ultimately, he only served 7 years. They reduced the minimum sentence without telling me, and I later went and got that law changed and a bunch of other laws changed. So every time they kept, I had a horrible experience with the criminal justice system. I just, you know, went and got a law changed. I became a very, I became an activist. And wrote a grant and started a hospital crisis team for battered women and taught survivors like myself to be the counselors to go into the emergency room on call when battered women showed up. Because there had been nobody was there for me. Nobody talked to me about why I was there. I might as well have been in a car wreck. I was admitted to the hospital. The knife had gone down to my intestine. They sewed me up and put me in a room, and he was still out there somewhere, and I was in a complete panic, as you can imagine. Some stranger had taken my baby from me, a still nursing baby, 8 months old. And, you know, I was there by myself with nobody, no chaplain, no social worker for 3 days. And I thought nobody should ever have to go through this. So that was the first project that I started.
Oh, I so commend you for that. And I know exactly what you're saying. And in so many instances in my life, I was alone. And I wasn't alone because I had God, but that's what made me the advocate. And I've been, you know, fighting this with others like you and Maria and all of us that have joined hands together. And I really see today that there are so many generals like you on the front lines, and you're not going down. Your shield is so solid that this will never, ever, ever happen again. And if you can be someone's shield, you're there. And so I commend you, Julie. No. Honestly,
well, you know, it's the biggest blessing. I got to tell you, the work that I do, it is a mission, it is a ministry, it is a calling. You know, it doesn't matter where I work and where my paycheck is coming from. I know what I'm supposed to be doing. And, you know, the work I do on my own time is what really fills me up. And that's when I have the opportunity to teach and to train and to do a lot, particularly within the churches, because I feel like there are so many women trapped in those pews that are being told there's no such thing as divorce, you know, go home, pray harder, submit to your husband. And the scriptures have been twisted in such a way that literally people have lost sight of the fact that God loves them and wants them to have a good life, and that there is absolutely no biblical basis for being in an abusive relationship, because the marriage vows have been broken by the abuser. The covenant is broken when the abuse takes place. And if a woman leaves an abuser, she is simply making that public. it is no longer a marriage. And I think that's so hard for so many women in the church, because so often scriptures like Ephesians, in Ephesians, you know, wives, submit yourself to your husband, that they get beat over the head with that, but nobody reads the next verse, husband, submit yourself to your wife. So the idea of mutual submission, the idea together, mutual submission to Christ together, the idea of partnership and mutuality and biblical equality is not taught enough. And there's this hierarchy, like the military, you know, like you have to have a boss, and then you have to have a CO and a XO, and then the kids are the troops. That's not even a biblical model for the family. That's something that's been taught, but it's not biblical.
Absolutely. And that, you know, that power that the man is head of the household, it really does go to some men's heads. And God has a call, you know, on a woman just as equal as he has on a man. And I was called to ministry.
Yes.
And so having that calling, I fought with the choices I made in marrying unequally yoked.
Mm-hmm.
And so in writing my story, I write about 4 failed marriages.
Mm.
And it's not something I'm proud of, but I use that to show people 4 different types of abuse and how I made that mistake. And I'm accountable for it. But I wanted people to see and hear how it actually happens,
mm-hmm.
so that they don't make the same mistakes I made.
Right.
And here standing after coming out of it, I admit that I see things differently now, and I saw some of it then, but made choices because I had already gotten married that I wanted to make it work.
Right.
And I was fighting longer because I was a Christian, because I believed that God would change them.
Right.
But I was trying to change them in my mind more than letting God change them.
I know. We say we know we can't change them, but we still try, don't we?
Yes.
How many psychiatrists did I drag him to? But, you know, it's interesting when you talk about, you know, the headship and all, because there's a lot of biblical scholarship going on right now. And my mentor, Dr. Catherine Clark Crager, who died in her 80s over a year ago, I'm so sad to say, was a brilliant, brilliant biblical scholar at Gordon Conwell Seminary in Boston. Her Bible that she read every day, all day, was the original Greek. She discovered that the word head in the Greek that's used in those contexts about headship, it means source, like the source of a river, the head of a river. It's not like head in the dominant, it has nothing to do with hierarchy. And so, you know, there's so much to still be learned. That we make these assumptions when someone interprets a scripture a certain way that's action, and so we've just sort of bought that without ever really, you know, looking further or reading further or even, you know, not being told that there are other ways that these words in the scripture are interpreted, you know. So it's very, you know, I keep learning. You know, it's a process. Survival is a process. You survive and then you thrive, you know. And the longer you get away from the abuse, the physical abuse, the clearer your head, the more open you become to other ideas. I mean, I've evolved over 25 years because I was really in that place, too, where I was trapped. Because I was raised as a preacher's kid. I knew the scriptures backwards and forwards. You know, I knew I was supposed to forgive 70 times 7. You know, I did believe marriage is forever. I didn't realize that he had broken the covenant. I thought by leaving him, I would be breaking the covenant. So I had to be retaught a lot.
Yes.
And you know, God's brought me a long, long way since then.
Julie, I wanted to know, what is available with the programs and stuff that you have put together for a hospital model, such as I'm in the emergency room, and I'm also a parish nurse there, so I have some respect with being in a Catholic facility, even though I'm not Catholic, and they know me very
mm-hmm.
well. And
mm-hmm.
we have brought domestic violence to one of their meetings and talked to them about this to make their eyes open more? Is there something that they can purchase, or how is your...
Well, you know, there are all kinds of things now. You know, back in the early 90s when I developed the manual for training emergency department personnel, there wasn't. I think it was probably one of the first ones, but I never published it. Now there are lots of things. There's a great National Domestic Violence Healthcare Project out of San Francisco. The name of the organization, they changed the name of their organization, and I'll have to get you that information. It's run by Esta Solar in San Francisco. It used to be called Family Violence Prevention Fund, and they've changed their name. And we'll come back to that. I'll think about that name, and I'll get it for you before we're finished talking. But so there are great, and there's even an annual domestic violence healthcare conference that is fantastic, and of course I've presented there, you know, on a number of occasions, and there are great materials that can be used with for hospitals and emergency rooms. I've done a lot of that training. The agency is called Futures Without Violence.
Okay.
Futures Without Violence, and there are numerous books. There are just so many. That it's almost too much. But if you contact Futures Without Violence, that would be a great start.
Here's the problem. Emergency nurses are already very busy.
Yes.
So you get a victim of domestic violence, you know, an assault, and you see it on your tracker, and immediately the nurses go, okay, that's a two-hour deal. I'm going to be stuck with that patient.
Right.
And they have no, some of them don't have the patience to deal with all the things that person needs.
Mm-hmm. And that's what we did, though. And that's what you have to do. And we've got one here. A lot of the bigger hospitals now have a crisis team for battered women. Mine was community-based, which was rare because we would go to any hospital or healthcare setting that would call us. First of all, though, you have to train them what number to call, and then you have to have people that will come. And my team also did it with the police eventually on site at the domestic violence scenes, because it takes the heat off of the doctors and the nurses and the police officers, because they're not counselors. They can't offer confidentiality and safety planning and all of that. But once the professionals realize that this is going to make my job easier. It's not going to give me more to do. It's going to give me less to do, and it's going to actually help the patient more than getting a memorandum of understanding with the hospital is not that hard to do. And now with American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, that is one organization that has all kinds of material. So does the American Medical Association, but also the accreditation organizations that accredit hospitals now have certain standards that are required, taking photographs and providing resources. And so hospitals want to meet those standards.
We have resources, but you know what it's like to a victim when you hand them a piece of paper?
Mm-hmm.
And they're not in the mood or mode in their mind to make those calls.
Right, and
when
there are teachers sitting
advocate,
out there waiting for them.
Exactly. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, but if you had the time and it was your job and you had permission in your healthcare setting to go, look, I've been where you've been. I don't know how you feel, but I know how I felt. And you can get help, and you don't have to live like this, and here's where you call. And you put it in their hand, and it is the number of your local domestic violence hotline. And that's what you do, because you cannot be, you're not responsible for getting her out of her relationship, but you are responsible for supporting her and believing her and referring her to the experts that she can contact when and if she's ready. That we have to do.
Right, and we have the police who come, and we have a social worker, you know, if she's available to come talk. But a lot of times, and if I'm not the one that is there, you see people leaving, and they're still
in a bad way.
Right.
And so we're fighting hard right now, and fortunately they have me, who's been an advocate for years, on their staff, and I'm really working to get, nurses to take the training as just
mm-hmm.
part of a curriculum to have in their knowledge base.
Well, I think that's very important, and I can help you with, I can give you more information. It's a big, big topic, but I do think it's terribly important because there are only certain places where battered women or abused women get to go. One is to the doctor or the emergency room. So they take their kids to pediatricians, they go to the dentist, they may go get health care checks, they may go to their OBGYN for checkups or when they're pregnant. You know, communities of faith is another place. So when abusers isolate their victims, they may let them go to those places. So it's imperative that in those places people are trained. And in the bathrooms in those places, we have little cards, free cards, you know, that they can stick in their shoe that has the help information on it. Because where they do get to go, that's where we can reach them, because they're not going to get to go other places, because isolation is a common thread that runs through abusive relationships. So it's a community problem, and the whole community has to be a part of it, and that's why coordinated community response and task forces are so important, because we all have to work together. We can't leave it up just to the healthcare system and just to, you know, communities of faith or just to law enforcement for that matter, because it's going to have to be the schools, the health, other kinds of health services and health departments, social services. We all have to be a part of the answer, because it's everybody's problem.
Julie, we only have a few minutes left, and I wanted really to make mention that you were a part of the research on the post-traumatic stress disorder information and the CAT scan that... Or the PET scan.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Can you talk briefly about that? We only have a few minutes, but I really think it's important to share your research.
Well, we did work, and of course, lots of work has continued since then. The National Center for PTSD is part of the Veterans Administration, Department of Veterans Affairs. And because I had post-traumatic stress disorder, I was interested in the changes that take place in the brain and how that intersects with our, you know, psychology and the aftermath of trauma. But when people are traumatized, their brain chemistry can change because of all of the chemicals that flow through the brain. And we can see some of those in PET scans and some of the newer technology. So, you know, adrenaline causes people to be agitated, and some of the symptoms that people have, irritable, agitated, hard to focus and pay attention and not always be on hyper alert. And then there are opiates that are released from the brain that numb you in the moment, and those can actually numb the feelings and keep people in a difficult place relationship-wise after a trauma. So what's important to know is that these help in the trauma, but afterwards, if these chemicals continue to flow, they can really get in the way of our functioning. But it's a normal response to an abnormal event or circumstance, and there are treatments that are available. And so victims need to know, if you have these symptoms, if you're having nightmares and flashbacks and all of that, it doesn't mean you're crazy. There's nothing wrong with you that isn't normal, but there is help for it. And so we started developing some cognitive behavioral therapies that help survivors work on their thoughts, which can change their feelings, which actually can change their brain chemistry. That's the miracle of it all. None of this has to be permanent. And we know God heals, but this even works for people who aren't believers. Our bodies are amazing, amazing instruments. And we don't have to let the trauma rule our lives forever, because we can heal physically, psychologically, emotionally, and spiritually.
Amen. I know, Julie, being released from post-traumatic stress syndrome is a big deal, because I, for years, relived a attack that I had at 16 years old, where I was in a hotel room and raped by a stranger.
Oh.
And for years, I went and opened
and shut windows and made sure they were locked and doors before I could go to bed. And I
classic
would be in,
symptom of PTSD.
Yeah.
Classic.
So I was relieved when God let it go, when I finally let God heal me.
Yes. Well, you know, you got to use all the tools you got. And you know, you got God, you've got therapy, you've got some good medications that can help with anxiety. I believe in using the toolbox. God gave us a lot of different things to use to heal us. And, you know, what works for one person may not work for the other. So I believe we got to use whatever it takes. And I want to say something about that, what happened to you, because you said you were in four abusive relationships. But I want to tell you, you didn't pick them. They picked you. This is what we have to remember, is that victims don't choose abusers. Abusers pick victims. And there's a lot to be learned about that, because when you've been victimized as a young person, you are more vulnerable and you have more, you have ways of dealing with aggression that are different than if you hadn't been abused. And it's easier to control someone who's afraid and who's been abused in the past. And abusers pick up on that. They're excellent at that. So
absolutely.
Yeah.
That's why I wrote my story from the time I first was a victimized at age two. I was not that. It was not my fault.
Nope.
I learned to survive, and I had a call from God to share my story, and I'm thankful today sharing my story and meeting women like you. And I just thank you, Julie. You are like a torpedo that hits the world with what you have gained and what you have done. And so I just
well, I
want
to be a peace bomb.
Yes, you are. And you know,
Susie, we're out of time, so we need to hurry up.
Okay. God bless you, Julie, and
God bless you.
Thank all of you listening to Soul Sister Radio. See you next week. I'm Susan Shengazar, the
Soul Sister Radio.
Rebecca Lawler Limited is the culmination of a lifelong dream for philanthropist and designer Rebecca Lawler. She designed her patented, unique glass heart, which is handcrafted by glass artists in Virginia. Placed in the center is a brilliant gem. The heart can be worn with the Rebecca Lawler Limited signature ribbon or an awareness ribbon of choice. To join the mission of the Hearts of Hope Foundation and add a Rebecca Lawler signature heart to your own personal style, go to RebeccaLawlerLimited.com. That's RebeccaLawlerLimited.com.
Hello, Soul Sister listeners. If you're learning and receiving from what you're being fed here on Soul Sister Radio, return the love by becoming a monthly partner of this station via sponsorship, monetary gifts, or as a Soul Sister advertiser. Thank you for your support. Soul Sister Radio.
Welcome back to Soul Sister Thursday. This is Maria DiGiovanni, and I want to welcome you to Soul Sister Radio and Women on the Edge with Becky Ryan. Becky, it's all yours.
Hello, Maria. It's Becky Ryan calling in to, I shouldn't say calling in, we're on the radio. So I am using my phone, but I'm talking to you via Atlanta, Georgia, and it has been a hot day, and I actually went and did some running today.
Ew.
Clear out my head, and really after a half a mile, I was sweating as if I had just finished a marathon. What does that say?
It's humid and hot, and how can you do that to yourself after living in California?
Oh, and it was at 5:30, and it was beyond hot.
Yeah.
I had trickles of sweat, so it looked like it was really professional, though. So I don't know. I looked the part as if, you know, like people are like, oh, did you just do 6 miles? I just got on here.
Yes, it was awful.
Well, we've got to get you out here more, though. I have been going through a lot of trends. There's a couple things I want to touch on lightly, and because I don't have enough information, but Paula Deen is all over the news.
Yeah,
and.
And tell me, again, I try not to watch the news. I try not to. And we talked a little bit about it. But for our audience,
yeah,
those other countries that have no idea what's going on, Who is this Paula Deen, and why is she crying?
Well, Paula Deen is a celebrity chef out of our famous Georgia. I don't know if we should be saying that. Out of Savannah, Georgia. And she has a restaurant. It really is a globally recognized restaurant for her food. Her sons have taken it over. They are sous chefs. And Paula Deen went ahead and started doing a show on the Food Network. And it's crumbling right now because she had used racial slurs in a very negative way. And I was talking to you. I think I've made fun of every race because I am the most mixed up Heinz 57. I've called my brother a bohemian. I mean, I was telling you this.
Right.
But I haven't gone in and used a racial slur because my parents came out of the 60s beating us in the head that women are equal to men. Both people should be doing the work. All races are equal. Growing up in the Midwest and coming to Atlanta, Georgia during the 80s was actually a paradigm shift. In a lot of ways, Atlanta, Georgia, in the inner circle, and it has progressed. So for people that want to come here, we had the Olympics. We're a fun state. But there was a lot of poverty here. And I actually think poverty has a lot to do with racism more than education. Now, I do believe that there's highly educated people that could be racist.
Okay, but why do you think that? Why do you think that?
I found that I even find that people tend to swear more when we're in, See, I'm doing a Paula Deen, so I apologize, but thank goodness I'm not in the Food Network. Home Depot isn't sponsoring us yet. Walmart left her. But I would expect more out of Paula Deen. I expect more out of our leaders. I expect more out of people that I think we look up to. And I never really followed Paula Deen. Jeff, my husband, loved her food. He says, I would watch it, and he said way back before she became a diabetic, and I don't know if you know this, but she was famous for very rich, very heavy fried foods. That's what Jeff had told me. And he said, I would watch it and feel my cholesterol rise. And I was like, well, was it good food? And he said, oh, it was the best.
Right.
She ended up being diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. And that made it in the news last year. So she redid everything, and she's diabetic-friendly. So she's come up with all of these My Famous Recipes, and here it's diabetic-friendly. We both don't have TV, so I haven't been able to really follow her. But even when I do watch TV, I don't watch the Food Network. I get hungry. I can be hungry while I'm eating, and I don't even like the food I'm eating then.
Right.
She had gone down to a restaurant in Louisiana, and she used a word that I think most of us have 86th from our language, but it isn't something that I think that the 60s and 70s and prior to that would have felt indifferent. And I'm not sure how old Paula Deen is. Do you have an idea?
No, I have no idea.
I'm going to actually wiki this. I'm wondering. I mean, like, she probably grew up with this. 1947. So she's
okay.
In her 60s.
She's in her early 70s, right?
47? No, she's still 60s, right? We can do the calculations later. For those that are viewing this in the future. I didn't say I was a mathematician.
Really, no.
I'm thinking that she's like 63. I have no idea now. Oh, my gosh. She'd be almost. You're right. She'd be.
I have no idea. That's terrible. Hey, I don't do
She's
numbers.
Mid-60s.
I don't do black and white, and I don't do numbers. Okay.
Well, you're making me pull up my calculator. I ran today. I am like, no. 66.
Okay, she's 66. All right.
That's probably a horrible number going down in her life. 6'6", and she's probably like born in the 6th month, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, no kidding, man. She's just having a bad year.
Yeah, this is a bad year.
Well, when I first moved down here, we were having I never even knew the Ku Klux Klan was in existence.
Yeah, I just found out that it's still like happening down there in the South. I had no idea.
Well, now I haven't seen, and I did see them. They would be on the street corners, like those other, you know, kooks that might be handing out flyers or whatever.
Right.
And it was, the funny thing is, and this isn't funny, I know that they have done so much wrong. This is just my naivety. My best friend in Sweden, she was an au pair, she had come, and we had seen that they were going to be having a march with Oprah Winfrey. And we're like, you've got to be kidding. And she's from Sweden. She goes, nobody's racist anymore. Oh, my gosh. Her and I had no idea of how close to slavery we were. I mean, I felt that it was generations. I mean, I thought it was like during the time of Jesus. And so, you know, being a high school student, and even in our school, it was interracial. Our school in Minnesota and Wisconsin, they were interracial. Never thought anything of it. So coming here to think this, we saw humor. Now, there is no humor in this. There's no humor in the Nazi Party. There's no humor in any. But when you first go into this, we were like, how ancient, people are going to stone these people. This is going to be funny. So we drove up to Cumming, Georgia, and that's where the march was with Hosea Williams, Oprah Winfrey. And we were not there for the march, but we went up just before. And there was normal dressed people, some people with parts of a Ku Klux Klan outfit. And we're laughing and we're like, oh, my goodness, they're using bed sheets. These are like retarded. We were dying laughing. We then got one of the flyers. And the flyer said, if you are a Yankee, a foreigner, Catholic, Maria and I went, oh, my God. And that was our word. Oh, my God. God, these people hate everything. And when we went home, this is back in the time before you could do emails, Marie wrote people, and we ended up grabbing some of the other flyers. She sent it back home to her dad, who was in the press. And he wrote about it. We were horrified. Then he wrote us back, like, what kind of idiots are you? There are people that probably were, that you would know, that are probably still slaves, that would remember they were brought up into some sort of a slavery mindset. And we're like, you've got to be kidding. He goes, no, it's 100 years in, like, 1975. And I was like, what? We had no clue. Now, Paula Deen does. We need to remove it. We're America. We're a melting pot. When she went down to say what she said, it was wrong. I'm happy she apologized. You and I were both talking about this. We've heard worse. We've heard meaner people. Martha Stewart, what's up with her? Embezzling, horrible human rights, and she gets an ankle bracelet and gets her own show.
Yeah.
And then you have another guy down the street who's ruined 50,000 people's homes and lives. I really don't know. I think we need a better justice system. What do you think?
I think God's walking us all through something right now that's going to bring a light to that. I think our justice system, well, I've known our justice system is a little off for quite some time. And it's funny because someone posted, it was Star from Voices Amplified, and she is the co-host of Safety First is Murphy's Law, our show that we do on
Monday.
Phenomenal. And I forgot what I was saying with that. Hello.
Well, she's a brilliant lady, and she posted something. Or was it somebody on her website?
Totally just left my head. What were we talking about just now?
About how our legal system is.
Oh, okay. And just no, I totally lost it. Forget it. This is live TV or live radio.
No, we're on TV. I was on the phone. No, we're on radio. For future internet people who might not know what radio is. It's kind of like Skype.
I totally lost my train of thought. Can you believe it? Keep going.
Well, I was thinking about this in raising up people.
She posted a book called Mothers on Trial, and it triggered such a memory of me when I was up against my first husband who was law enforcement. And, again, nowhere did I think in a million years in our justice system would I lose custody of my child. And that is the biggest fear that every officer's wife has. And I've lived it. I've lived the nightmare. And the reason why he won custody was not because I was a terrible, unfit mother. It was because he was the more credible witness. Well, how do you compete against a cop that's talking to judges that he works with all the time? Okay.
Yeah.
So our justice system is a little off, and it has been for some time. Nicole Brown did not die in vain. Some laws have changed. However, sadly, what I've come to learn in the last 2 to 3 weeks is that we have such a fractured system that it's so blatantly obvious that as an advocate for women who have lost their voices, God's put me in a position where I really need to open my mouth. And it's an interesting position to be in.
Well, there's more to that. We were even kind of talking, even though we didn't mention this part, opening our mouth up and how a lot of things, and I'm going to pull our viewers back into a previous conversation. We had talked about how people can have pains and hurts, and it came up because Steve Jobs, who I'd been researching and reading about his leadership, had gone through a life experience where it was a Buddhist situation where he believed a lot of our pains, our ailments, our tiredness, our lack of motivation, fears, might have been from previous life. It might be because of something that somebody's doing to you outside of your sphere, or that you're not answering or doing something you're supposed to be doing. And we can kind of throw this into a Christian mindset, you know, even if you don't believe in the previous lives, we're basically saying that there's something going on with us that we don't understand, and it's going on. We could have headaches. We could have problems with our legs. We can have, I don't know, the inability, depression, a lot of these mental illnesses that are coming out. And not coming out, they may have been here. It's just that we're not giving them a name. And he ended up going and praying about it. He would go and eat. He'd meditate about it. And he'd get over it. And what was really sad is this had worked for him for almost 50 years. And he had overcome so much. He would work through pain. He would keep pushing himself forward, and it would always go away. When he got the diagnosis that he had pancreatic cancer, he decided to go back to his old ways. He's going to meditate. He's going to try holistic foods. He's going to be trying, prayers, certain ointments, exercises, and when he went back in 9 months later, it had spread. He ended up needing a transplant. He ended up having it spread even farther, and it was a waste. Now, all people need to see the doctors, what we had gotten out of it, but for 50-some years, this guy kept on proving to himself that almost all of our ailments mean we have to do something. If you're hurting, your ankles are hurting, your legs are hurting, you might truly be medicating yourself, and you might be over-medicating, and I think America needs to reevaluate that. Do you have anything to say?
I have to. You know how I feel about that, especially, you know, since I truly believe when I was married to my first husband, I was sick. I was sick all the time. And there was no way that I could have what it was that they were telling me I had. At one point, they told me I had pulmonary hypertension. Well, people die of that, and there's no getting over it. And I'm thinking to myself, there's no way that I am this sick, that I'm in a situation that is making me sick. And I'm telling you, 20 years ago, this jaw was broken. And it has been fine except for the last 2.5 years. And it was fine as of March. And I went and put myself in another, situation that has caused me to have to stand back and reevaluate whether or not my choice is going to be to open my mouth or not. So I'm sure that my ailments are a physical manifestation of an emotional issue that I am having. And I truly believe that more now than ever.
I even believe in it through my own walk. Now, I still want to go and say Steve Jobs could have had a surgery and been alive today.
Uh-huh.
So I do believe in our doctors. When they finally see what it is, let's get rid of it. But how many times I've had headaches and I was able to go through it? Or I found that I was continuously getting allergies, colds, difficulty wanting to stay awake. And at the end of the day, I found out that it was also in my most stressful periods of time. So I think we are beings that, like our bodies are telling us, hey, the mind is overworked here. Or the mind is not doing what it's supposed to do, and the answer is inside. Pray and figure this one out and get up and start doing some work. Which leads me back, and the only reason I was bringing this one up is to go back to last week's show on people not speaking up when they see something's wrong.
Ah.
And, yeah, is that kind of, I shouldn't have gone as far, but was it a nice transition?
Here we go. Well, we have 9 minutes left, so actually
okay,
8
good.
Minutes left, so.
And this is going to lead us into what I'm wanting to launch for 6 weeks, our next 6 weeks. I want to empower women because at the end of the day, sometimes we're put into situations and we don't know how to handle it. And with my son getting out of the Marines boot camp next week, I'm thinking about how they train soldiers. And they keep putting them into situations to get them to react. So that when the reaction goes through, it's gut instinct for the correct answer. We keep telling people what's right or wrong. We can do the Monday night review of the football game.
You there?
Can you hear me on that? What do you call the person that goes and, it's always the thereafter. And I don't want us to be wondering what we should have done the day after. I don't want us to be dwelling on what we should have done 3 months ago, 3 years ago. I want us to go and start a new path that we're going to go on forgiving what has happened in the past and knowing that there's some skills that we need to go forward on. And I want to have all of our leaders get some leadership skills that we can find online. We're going to use high-tech methods to ease our lives and empower our listeners. I don't know if every show is going to be for each individual listener. I promise you it won't be. I promise there's going to be things you're going to know more. But I'm going to go and move forward to helping people get the gut reaction back. That when we see that something's wrong, we don't just sit there. But what should we do? I mean, some of the situations, like an officer going into a domestic violence, you're not supposed to go and help instigate it more.
Yeah.
But I think we need to go and come up with that. And next week we're going to be talking about some cool leadership tapes. We're going to go to some sites to reevaluate your site, so if you have a business one. And then we're going to go right into 5 more steps to start getting us to self-reflect and be better women, men, children, adults, parents, bosses, co-workers. I don't know what we can do, but I know that through our leadership program, building people up, and through you, Maria, who's been building
all of us up. This is actually a tribute to you. And I fear we can do some small nuggets and we'll have fun doing it and holding each other accountable.
I think it's going to be amazing because this has been a huge piece of this puzzle, and I think God's timing is perfect, and I know that he's going to provide for us to be able to move forward, and I'm excited about it.
Well, we're going to also talk about like some of the things that we're putting online and how we have to evaluate what we are putting out there, because it is out there. We're going to also be holding each other up to putting out things that represent what your future is going to be and not your past. We're overcomers. We're going to be helping other people. And I want to call each and every one of the listeners that we have to say, yes, you want to go ahead and be a better person in 2013. And we're not going to do any of these Paula Deans. I mean, like Paula Deen, reason why I was bringing it up in a way was to go and say she's too old to be using something that she might have thought was trying to say when she was six.
Mm-hmm.
She's too old for a teenager's words. This is a lady that people respected. And I believe she can change this around and probably start her own network. She has mm-hmm. the talent. She has the ability. She has the heart. If she truly is sorry on this, I feel that she has much to accomplish, more than a Martha Stewart. And I feel that our leaders, our coming leaders, our kids, our daughters, who need to find out that they have more empowering, and we've been fighting for them, and my parents have been fighting for, my grandmother in the 1907s was fighting for women's mm-hmm. liberation. So, how are you? Are you talking still?
Well, I'm excited to see what's going on, and again, I think it's all come to this point for a time such as this. Even, you know, coming from Saddleback Church and Rick Warren, he really does, you know, raise people up to be leaders. And one of our new guardians, who's actually an old guardian, he's actually starting the Purpose-Driven Life in Japan. So we are being surrounded by leaders, and so I'm just excited that you've taken the lead on this. Yippee. Because
well, now we're going to go ahead. We're going to have it soft. I'm going to go and look for, I already have some places where you can test yourself. I want to put them out there. And it's going to be fun. You're going to definitely learn something. And we're going to be holding each other accountable, because 2013 is going to go down as a paradigm shift. We are going to make 2013 exceptional. And we're going to say that this is where, you know, like wherever you were. If you were already exceptional, we're taking this super exceptional. If you're wondering where you should be right now in your life and where God is driving you, we're going to be finding it. And you're going to be finding it within yourself. When it comes to those headaches and other things that are holding us back, we're not supposed to be held back. We're supposed to be doing God's work.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that we're down to, what, 1 or 2 minutes?
You have 2 minutes, yes.
2 minutes. So, again, I'm Becky Ryan. You can contact me on Facebook under Woman on the Edge. And next week, we're going to be starting a leadership. We're going to do some light stuff. We're going to have some fun. I'm going to be getting some personality tests out there so you can find out where you are. And we're going to go into some key rules to help you really self-reflect. Do you really have the influence? Do you really have the friends? Do you need to build it up, and where should you be going? And we're going to start putting that in there. And I'm looking forward to taking all of our leaders, soon to be, and laying the seed here, all of our leaders to the next level.
Well, I'm excited. I'm totally
excited.
Well,
have fun. We're going to have fun. We're going to find out, you know, I found out that back in the 1910, they had a psychiatric book that was only 300 pages. Right now, they have desk references on all of the mental illnesses that they have classified. And I'm just going, did we really just get like 300,000 different types of mental illnesses in a century?
Wow.
Or is it that we're really getting too self-absorbed?
Yeah.
And some of these things might make us special.
Yeah, exactly. Wow. All right, say
300 and some odd thousand. Okay, yeah, have a great one. Have fun.
And we will see you next week on Soul Sister Thursday with Women on the Edge with Becky Ryan. Becky, thank you so much for choosing to have your show on Soul Sister Radio. We will see you next week.
Soul Sister Radio.
Rebecca Lawler Limited is the culmination of a lifelong dream for philanthropist and designer Rebecca Lawler. She designed her patented, unique glass heart, which is handcrafted by glass artists in Virginia. Placed in the center is a brilliant gem. The heart can be worn with the Rebecca Lawler Limited signature ribbon or an awareness ribbon of choice. To join the mission of the Hearts of Hope Foundation and add a Rebecca Lawler signature heart to your own personal style, go to RebeccaLawlerLimited.com. That's RebeccaLawlerLimited.com.
Soul Sister Radio.